here at Oswiecim railway station until at least 1943, most persons destined for the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp made their first stop.
In the past 10 years, we have visited most of the still existing concentration camps in Europe, including Auschwitz, Bergen-Belsen, Buchenwald, Dachau, Oranienburg, Sachsenhausen and Neuengamme. We have gathered and studied the official information brochures and archives in the museums of these camps. We have interviewed cremation experts, chemists, engineers and some survivors of these camps. Dr. Frederick Tobin of the Adelaide-based Adelaide Institute has been studying the so-called Jewish Holocaust for more than 30 years. In April 1997, Dr. Tobin travelled to Poland to visit the most notorious of all World War II concentration camps, Auschwitz. Eyewitness testimonies, books, and movies, ignoring the physical evidence, have all added to the legend of this most infamous camp. We say legend because the stories told by the books, movies, and eyewitnesses have all been based on cruel wartime propaganda. And how many of you watching this video right now have ever gone to the trouble to find out if this propaganda is anywhere near true? This video is the culmination of many years' intensive study of the actual facts, the still existing evidence, and Dr. Tobin's visit to Auschwitz. All we ask of you is to listen to the evidence and judge for yourself.
This door opened into the air raid shelter. As you can see, it has a peephole, and as we open it inwards, you can see that it looks into or at a wall, befitting an air raid shelter. The first wall here, this vestibule, leads into the air raid shelter, where a second door you can see, is supposed to be gas tight. That is the problem anyone is faced with, worrying about this idea of having a gas chamber, as I now open the door. This video offers a critical look at that part of World War II history called the Holocaust. In particular, of the alleged mass gassings of prisoners in German concentration camps. The Holocaust is always blamed on the German people, but a Holocaust on 6 million Jews was already being bemoaned in Jewish literature in 1919, at least 14 years before Adolf Hitler came to power. Since 1945, the Holocaust has been blown out of all historical context, and now worldwide there are more memorials reminding us of the Holocaust than there are of any other single event in history. Any person who honestly and openly questions the Holocaust dogma is attacked as being a racist, anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, a hater. For over 50 years, the Jews and Germans alike have been suffering from the after effects of this hoax. Healing can only take place when the world is able to openly discuss the facts about this event. We name this video "Judea Declares War on Germany," because the historical facts show it was international Zionism that wanted to destroy Germany and Hitler, and not the other way around. Let me summarize a speech given by the Jewish millionaire businessman and political advisor, Mr. Benjamin Friedman, in Washington in 1961. Mr. Friedman knew exactly what he was talking about, because he was an insider at the highest levels within international Jewish organizations and a personal friend of at least four United States presidents.
He was also a member of the 117-strong Zionist delegation at the signing of the Versailles Peace Treaty. In Paris in 1919, where Germany was forced into bankruptcy and social chaos. Mr. Friedman says that 2 years into World War I, Germany, which then was winning the war, offered Great Britain and France a negotiated peace deal. But German Zionist groups, seeing an opportunity, made a deal with Britain and to get the United States into the war if Britain promised to give the Jews Palestine. The British agreed. And using blackmail, the United States Zionists brought great pressure to bear on President Wilson, and the United States entered and won the war for Great Britain and France. The British, as promised, signed the Balfour Declaration, which gave Palestine to the Jews. In his book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, Professor Anthony Sutton describes how in 1933, Hitler, needing to repay huge war reparations and having to rebuild the German nation, was lent huge sums of money by international Jewish financiers such as the Warburgs, J.P. Morgan, Chase Manhattan, and Kuhn Loeb Banks, who were hoping for huge profits from exorbitant interest rates. The Germans had since recognized they'd been stabbed in the back by German Zionists, and they resented this. So they were only too happy when Hitler came up with his final solution to the Jewish problem, which was an agreement reached with German Zionist groups to have 4 million European Jews either emigrate or be deported to the island of Madagascar. The international Zionists, fearing their influence in Europe was dwindling fast, met in Amsterdam in 1933 and demanded Hitler stop the deportations immediately and take all Jews back. When Hitler defied their demands, the international Zionists, represented by Mr. Samuel Untermeyer, then declared worldwide war and boycott on Germany. Hoping to maintain some form of power in Europe, the international Zionists managed to sabotage and stop the immigration of many thousands of Jews, thereby condemning these fellow Jews to imprisonment in concentration camps. After all, the Jews were engaged in a self-declared war against Germany, and this made them enemies within their own country. To quote Mr. Benjamin Friedman once again, ultimately, the Zionists were also responsible for World War II. Hitler had no plans to murder Jews. He had no plans for world domination. He was a nationalist. Accusing Hitler of planning world domination covers up the fact that plans for world domination already existed long before Adolf Hitler came to power, and they were written by internationalists. These plans described in detail how this internationalist elite intends to gain control over all sovereign nations. By various methods, of course, which include driving them into debt or war, just as they did to Hitler's Germany. This group of internationalists not only destroyed Germany twice, they will attempt to destroy anyone who tries to get in their way. They will even try to stop you watching this video. In many parts of Western Europe, for example, just owning this video could get you a jail term. You are not supposed to learn these historical facts which are contained within this video. We do not offer you another version of historical truth, but historical facts, which we found in the camps themselves. You must decide what is true.
During World War II, many countries built concentration camps. In the United States, American Japanese were imprisoned only because of their race. Switzerland built concentration camps where refugees were forced to do heavy manual labor. Even Australia had concentration camps. The world's first concentration camps were set up by the British. Field Marshal Lord Roberts in Africa during the South African War of 1900, and expanded by this man, Lord Kitchener. A quarter of a million people were interred in these camps, and more than 50,000 of them, black and white, died of malnutrition and disease. In 1918, immediately after World War I, Poland, which had been granted large areas of German territory by the Treaty of Versailles, built the first two European concentration camps in the former German territory of Posen. They immediately imprisoned 16,000 Germans. In the next 8 years, the Poles built another half dozen camps, imprisoning more than 50,000 Germans and thousands of Ukrainians. The German Foreign Office even brought out a book entitled Documented Polish Atrocities, showing dozens of graphic photographs of the victims. This book has since been removed from sale. But it was a full-scale slaughter of German citizens in 1939 when Polish militia murdered 5,500 German men, women and children in the village of Bromberg that forced Hitler to send in his troops to protect his citizens, and which gave France and Great Britain the excuse to declare full-out war against Germany. When Hitler became Chancellor on the 30th of January 1933, the German nation was in deep financial despair. The country had been sabotaged by Zionists in the First World War, and the Treaty of Versailles was bankrupting the country. Millions were unemployed and their families were starving. Hitler knew that Zionist groups were behind Germany's defeat in the First World War, and he wanted them out of Europe. Together with the Zionist group Irgun Zwei Leumi, Germany and France had arranged to deport some 4 million European Jews to the island of Madagascar. In retaliation to the deportations, and only 6 weeks after Hitler took power on the 24th of March 1933, an influential American Zionist group, headed by Mr. Samuel Untermeyer, declared world war on Germany. This declaration made newspaper front covers worldwide. At the same time, Zionist lobby groups were dispatched to bully governments into boycotting Germany. Hitler hit back by ordering Jews to identify themselves as enemies of the Reich by wearing the yellow star. When Hitler marched into Poland to stop the atrocities, Britain and France declared war, and the Jews, who had also openly declared war on Germany, were interred in camps, as any nation would do to any enemy. On the 31st of October 1919, more than 14 years before Hitler came on the scene, the former governor of New York, Mr. Martin Glynn, wrote an article for the American Hebrew magazine entitled "The Crucifixion of Jews Must Stop." 6 times in the article, Mr. Glynn bemoaned the 6 million Jewish men, women, and children that were dying in a Holocaust. But as this was 20 years before the Second World War even started, nobody can blame this Holocaust on Hitler. Of course, what are 6 million dead when compared to the millions and billions of Jews murdered by the Romans and written about in the Jewish Talmud? When Germany was defeated in 1945, the Allies captured over 3,000 tons of written material. But nowhere in this material did any researcher find any orders or plans from the Nazi hierarchy to kill Jews. At the Nuremberg trials, the only evidence presented to the courts as proof that such a plan existed were the so-called Wannsee protocols. Wannsee is a beautiful wooded suburb of Berlin, and it is claimed that on the 20th of January 1942, a group of top Nazi officials under the leadership of SS Obergruppenführer Reinhard Heydrich met in a large villa to discuss the final solution of the Jewish question. The prosecution alleged the final solution alluded to a plan devised by the Nazi leadership to eliminate as many European Jews as they could get their hands on. Copies of these protocols are on show in various museums in the world, but only native Germans reading them would notice that whoever wrote these protocols had very little understanding of German grammar or of secretarial skills. The so-called Wannsee protocols are badly done fakes. Of course, after the war, the Allies had full access to all official Nazi stamps, typewriters, letterheads, and everything needed to create fake documents that could have been better than originals. But in the case of the Wannsee protocols, the faking was done so badly that today they would be laughed out of court. So the only document that was ever presented to the world as proof of an official Nazi murder plan is a document made by an amateur crook. There never was an official Nazi plan to destroy the chosen race. Today it is often claimed that the orders to kill Jews was handed down orally. Of course, with one of the best trained and disciplined armies in the world, one would have to be very naive to believe that Hitler whispered this order to his generals and they pass it down to the colonels, to captains, army to army, division to division, man to man. Such an order had to be written, and in millions of copies. But to date, no one has ever found such an order, because it never existed. These photos were taken in Auschwitz, Dachau, and Neuengamme, and they show us the conditions under which the prisoners had to work. And you must look very closely to even see a guard. The schedule for the working day looked like this. 5 a.m., wake up, make beds, dispense coffee. 6 a.m., roll call, work groups assembled, leave for work. 12, lunch break. 12:30, return to work. 6 p.m., end of work, return to camp. 9 p.m., lights out. Their clothing was sufficient to protect them from the harsh European winter. In this photo, you can see they had long coats, boots, earmuffs, and headwear. Prisoners were worked hard, and for any acts of sabotage, they automatically received the death penalty. But they were not subjected to the constant shelling, rifle fire, mines, grenades, bombing, or partisan attacks that German soldiers at the front were suffering day and night. According to the Auschwitz information brochure, prisoners received from 1,300 up to 1,700 calories per day, while most of the German population was only getting 900 calories per day. In this scene, we have accurately reproduced the daily food rations for prisoners in Auschwitz. For breakfast, each prisoner received half a liter of coffee, and for dinner, a liter of vegetable soup. Supper consisted of 300 to 350 grams of bread, 30 grams of margarine, 20 grams of sausage, and herbal tea or coffee. According to the German doctors in the camp, the food was sufficient, but not balanced. And towards the end of the war, even though the camp had its own vegetable gardens, food became very scarce, and some prisoners did suffer badly from malnourishment. However, the following photos were taken by the Allies at the liberation of Dachau. Neither the adult prisoners nor the children looked to be undernourished or starved. In Dachau, just behind the fake gas chamber called Brausebad, or showers, the tourist finds the real gas chambers. These chambers were used to disinfect the clothing and belongings of the prison inmates, with the intention of keeping them healthy. Obviously designed by German engineers, these chambers have metal doors with double locks, special pumps to take in and expel any pesticides or hot steam without injuring any personnel. Nobody has ever claimed that these chambers were used to gas people. Auschwitz-Birkenau was built on marsh ground. Large drainage ditches had to be dug around the camp. With the ground water level only around 30 centimeters below the surface, underground burials were impossible because of the danger of poisoning the drinking water. But the wet ground was the perfect breeding environment for insects and vermin. Fleas and lice spread sickness like wildfire throughout the camp, and by the end of the war, the Germans had registered the deaths of 74,000 prisoners from typhus. Around 800 meters towards the back of the camp is a very large building the inmates called the sauna. This building also housed dozens of gas chambers designed to save the lives of the prisoners. All prisoners arriving in Birkenau were first taken to the sauna building, where they had their hair cut, they were showered and registered, checked by a prison doctor and given a prison uniform. Sick prisoners were immediately sent to the camp hospital. Their clothes were then put into one of the many fumigation units and cleansed. These units, much like the ones in Dachau, were obviously carefully designed by engineers and built to typical German perfection. Most chambers had metal doors with multiple locks and piping to carry the pesticides in and out of the chambers without danger to the workers. Not only clothing was cleansed here, but also bedding and mattresses. Although most units in the sauna used hot air to fumigate clothing and mattresses, some units in other buildings used Cyclone B. It is evident by these scenes that the Germans went to a lot of trouble to ensure the health and safety of the prisoners working here. Had the Germans not installed these massive fumigation units, the death toll in the camp could have gone into the hundreds of thousands. As in Dachau, these chambers were never used to harm humans, but to save lives. Even before World War I, Cyclone B was used widely in the United States and Europe as a fumigant and pesticide. Health authorities throughout the world used large amounts of it to rid ships and buildings of vermin such as rats, fleas, and lice. It is a very dangerous chemical and must be handled very carefully. The smallest spark could set off a fire or even a violent explosion. Where the gas comes into contact with a metal or concrete surface, it tends to liquefy and permanently blend with the surface, giving it the typical dark blue coloring known as Prussian blue. After fumigation, which can take up to 24 hours in a room heated up to 26 degrees, the rooms must be aired for a minimum of 10 hours. Special clothing, such as an air-breathing unit, special suits and gloves are necessary to stop poisoning through the skin. Gas masks may only be used for 10 minutes. Smoking is forbidden. This protective clothing was not available in Auschwitz, so if thousands of dead bodies lay in gas-filled rooms, it was impossible to get them out again. For this video, we interviewed a number of people who had spent the war years in one or more of the camps. For example, Tatiana T., brought as a teenager to Auschwitz from the Ukraine. In 1945, with the Russian army advancing across Poland, Tatiana left Auschwitz with the German guards for Bergen-Belsen in Germany. Today, Tatiana still lives in the SS barracks in the Auschwitz Stammlager. And Martin, taken as a Polish prisoner of war to Dachau. Martin, who still visits the camp every day, took us on a tour of Dachau and showed us photos of his liberation in 1945 by the Americans. Neither Tatiana nor Martin remember any gas chambers in Auschwitz or Dachau. The testimony you are going to hear is that of Mr. Yehoshua Rosenblum, who claims to have been working in the Auschwitz gas chambers as a member of a Sonderkommando. Mr. Rosenblum's testimony is accepted by officialdom as being a typical and true account of the horrors of the alleged gas chambers in Auschwitz. We ask you to listen very carefully to this testimony because we will then show you the real and the fake gas chambers in Auschwitz and Dachau, and you may then decide for yourself if Mr. Rosenblum's testimony fits the facts.
Ich bin 6 Mann und ausgezogen und herangetrieben zu den Moskitos. Weil Rommel, sie kämpft in Afrika und hat eine gewusst von Malaria, da war der erste Experiment. Er macht schon wieder.
The people went in laughing and asking where they were. And we had to remain silent and not tell them what was about to happen to them. And after the last person had gone in, they shut the door from the outside. Then immediately, 2 SS men ran up and climbed up on chairs and threw the Zeppelin B in through the window, which were up quite high, and immediately we heard the screaming. And this went on for a few minutes, maybe 10 to 15 minutes. Afterwards, they opened the 2 doors on the other side from the yard, and they yelled at us, "Shrill, shrill, Rachel and the Hendren, quickly, pull out the bodies." The crematoriums were not big enough and they could only burn about 1,000 bodies each day. But in the pit, they could burn up to 15,000. In the 3 pits, they were very large pits, around 6 to 8 meters long and about 2 meters wide. And in each pit, they threw in 1,000 people. And it only took a few minutes to burn them completely. Maybe 30 minutes and they were completely burnt, or partly burnt. There were still a few hands or feet that had fallen out to the side, and we had to put them back on the fire. Nothing should remain of these people, just a bit of ash.
Well, in this facility, we've got the most modern crematorium ovens that exist. Our ovens, well, they burn at about 800 to 1,000 degrees Celsius on a mixture of natural gas and oxygen. The average corpse, well, it takes about 1.5 to 2 hours to burn. That's completely, but that depends on its state as well. If it's been stored in very cold or even frozen conditions, this can actually take an hour longer to burn. And even then, the bones don't completely burn to ash. They've got to be crushed in a machine down to a fine, gritty mixture, and this process takes about 10 to 15 minutes. No, crematoriums don't give off smoke, and we don't need chimneys. Even when we still use diesel to drive the ovens, they never gave off smoke. So if you see smoke, it's not from the corpses, but it could be from the fuel that's burning, but it's definitely not from the corpses. Well, what about coke? Coke is coal with all the volatile fuel taken out of it. Coke is difficult to get burning, and it's not an effective fuel for crematoriums. If it gets wet or even damp, it won't burn at all. Our retorts are not designed to burn multiple bodies, not at the one time, but if they were, it would definitely lengthen the time of the cremation quite considerably, because the heat wouldn't be able to circulate around the bodies. Well, it's practically impossible to burn large numbers of bodies to ash in pits. Just pouring fuel over a pile of bodies wouldn't work, because no air gets down to the fire. Just as a barbecue, if you do not have the air getting to the fire goes out. But even in house fires and aeroplane crashes, people don't burn to ash. They're only badly charred. What about burning corpses on tyres? Well, in India, it takes at least 3 to 4 hours to burn a body and around half a tonne of dried wood. As for burning 2,000 corpses on wooden pyres, well, you need around 1,000 tonnes of dried wood every day. It'd be impossible. And even then, the large bones never burn to ash. You'd still have to crush them.
Auschwitz, with hundreds of thousands of very old and often sick residents, had more than its share of problems, because the camps were situated in a very wet and marshy area of Poland, and with sometimes dozens of people dying of infectious diseases weekly, the bodies could not be buried underground because of the danger of them poisoning the drinking water and spreading disease even further. So the camp authorities built 5 crematoriums, powered by coke, one in the main camp and 4 in Birkenau. The coke was brought in from the close-by Auschwitz-Monowitz industrial complex, where they made synthetic oil from coal. Coke was a byproduct. You have heard a cremation expert tell you that coke is not a good fuel because its volatile oil has been removed, and if it gets damp or wet, it will not burn. Once the furnace is fired up, it takes an average of 40 kilograms of coke and just over an hour and a half to cremate one body. Coke, when it burns, leaves about 10% of its own weight in ash. So for every body burnt, there would be around 4 kilos of coke ash left over. An emaciated human body leaves around 1 kilogram of ash, which includes the crushed bones. We know exactly how many tons of coke were delivered to Auschwitz each year, because it was carefully noted down in the camp archives. So with just a little arithmetic, we can give a very good estimate of the numbers of bodies that could have been burnt with that amount of coke. Human bodies, being made up of 75% water, are not good fuel. so you can forget any wild claims you may have heard that in the camps bodies were being used to burn other bodies. It just doesn't happen. Camp records show that in 1943, for example, 641.5 tons of coke were delivered to Birkenau over an 8-month period. Because of the wet ground and inclement weather in Poland, the coke would have had to be delivered in small amounts, because there were no large storage facilities near to the crematoriums. If no coke at all was used to heat any of the hundreds of barracks, if no coke was used in any of the ovens to cook food for the camp, those 641 tons would just be enough to cremate only one body per retort per day, or altogether 16 bodies per day. In the same year, only 31.1 tons of coke were delivered to the main camp, and that was just enough coke to cremate only 2 bodies per day. This fact alone destroys the claim that thousands of people were being cremated every day. So the next questions must be, if we pretend for a minute the Germans had succeeded in gassing thousands of people in those 5 alleged gas chambers, one, what did they do to get rid of all the bodies? And two, without any bone-crushing machines, how did they crush the millions of bones to ash? You have heard an eyewitness claim that many thousands of bodies were burnt daily in large, deep pits. And you have heard our cremation expert tell you it is impossible to burn bodies to ash in pits. Well, let us see what happened when we asked a pyrotechnic expert to follow their methods and burn just 4 dry telephone books in a pit. We did this demonstration because we wanted to put the eyewitness testimony to the test, something those promoting the Holocaust have never done. So we asked a pyrotechnics expert to dig a small pit and burn 3 telephone books in it, following the method supposedly used by the Nazis for burning dead bodies. This experiment was carried out not in the marshy wetlands around Auschwitz, but in a dry, sandy Sydney park in the middle of summer. We know that telephone books are compacted dry paper and do not burn particularly well, but if you can prove that human bodies, which are made up of around 75% water, burn faster, better, or more easily than paper, please contact us. Eyewitnesses from Auschwitz report that a mixture of motor oil and methanol was poured over about 2,000 bodies in large pits. Our pit was very much smaller, and we had no methanol, so we made up a mixture of methylated spirits, kerosene and lamp oil, and poured the proportional equivalent of 300 litres over the telephone books. And at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we lit the fire. Despite the extra fuel, our books were very reluctant to burn, and after only 10 minutes, the fire slowly died down and went out. Undaunted, and wanting to give the official story every possible chance, we poured some more flammable fluid over the books, this time the proportional equivalent of 1,000 litres. And this time the flames took off, crackling and burning. We had now poured the equivalent of 1,300 litres of flammable material onto the books, something that would have been impossible to do every day in Auschwitz. They just never had that amount of fuel available. Twenty minutes passed. Mr. Rosenblum had stated that in 20 minutes, thousands of dead bodies had been reduced to ash. But in our experiment, the fire had not even burnt through a third of the top telephone book. You will notice in the camera close-ups that there is even sufficient space around the books for air to circulate easily. But even that was not enough to partly destroy one telephone book. You are watching the proof that burning thousands of human bodies in pits sounds very dramatic, but is practically impossible, especially if the bodies had been frozen, or it was snowing or raining as it does more than half the year in Auschwitz. After 40 minutes, our fire had gone out again, and our pyrotechnics expert was able to pull the unburnt telephone books out of the pit again. We did not continue with our efforts because we believe our point had been made. The alleged gas chamber in Dachau, shown to thousands of visitors per year, is right next door to the cremation ovens. It looks like we have all been told a gas chamber should look, with shower heads and peepholes in the door, etc. It once had a small plaque in it on the floor next to the entrance, where it was written, "Built by the Americans after the war." This plaque has been replaced by a larger sign which clearly states in five languages, "It was never used as a gas chamber." So it's just a Hollywood horror. In Auschwitz, there were five large crematoriums, and each it is claimed had its own gas chamber, inside or underground. Each building numbered from 1 to 5. These illustrations, taken from United States Air Force aerial photos, show crematoriums 2 and 3 in Auschwitz-Birkenau. They were mirror images of each other. Two underground chambers, numbered here 12 and 14, lead off at right angles from the main buildings. The rooms numbered 12 towards the top of the picture are claimed to have been the undressing rooms. The chambers with the numbers 14 are claimed to have been the underground gas chambers that could hold up to 2,000 people at one time. In 1944, prisoners destroyed Crematorium 4 in an uprising, and three others were blown up by the Russians 3 months after the war ended. Despite the Russians having captured three intact crematoriums with their supposed gas chambers, still no photos of any gas chambers exist. In these scenes, you are looking at photos and plans and the ruins of the old crematorium buildings. The gas chambers were given the names of the cremers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Homicidal gas chambers are very difficult to design properly. And the larger they are built, the more carefully designed they must be, especially if you are trying to avoid killing friends as well as foes. A well-designed gas chamber needs to have sealed tubing for getting the poison gas into the chamber. Windows are obviously useless and easily smashed. All necessary doors must be well sealed and lockable. And after the gassing, the hundreds of cubic meters of poisonous gas must be extracted from the chamber in a way that will not kill everyone in the vicinity. Of the 5 alleged homicidal gas chambers in Auschwitz, not one of them fulfilled any of these criteria. You have seen how the Germans took extreme care to build safe fumigation chambers for saving lives. These alleged homicidal gas chambers, where supposedly millions of people were killed, were silly Mickey Mouse constructions that were more dangerous to bystanders than to the condemned. None of the alleged chambers had heating systems to bring the Cyclone B crystals up to the 26 degrees necessary to give off the gas. None of them had gas extraction systems, and none of them show the telltale blue stains typical of Cyclone B poison. Creamers 4 and 5 were single-story buildings and totally unsuitable as gas chambers, with 14 rooms apiece, with some rooms having 4 unsealed doors. The alleged gas chambers in creamers 2 and 3 were supposedly underground. You have heard an eyewitness tell you how SS men got up on chairs and threw the Cyclone B crystals through windows in the roof down onto the people below. When it was blown up, the roof of Crema 2 collapsed down like a blanket, almost unbroken. We searched the roof area of Crema 2 from above and below, and nowhere could we find any holes. So, with no holes, there was no way they could have gotten the poison crystals into the chamber. And that probably explains why there were also no blue stains from Cyclone B. These rooms are perfect for what they were built for, as morgues, but are useless and dangerous as gas chambers. You are probably wondering about the holes we used to climb down through. Close inspection shows these holes were crudely smashed through the roof, and the steel reinforcing rods bent back. Hardly German engineering. In this photo, taken under Crema 2, Dr. Tobin is kneeling next to a solid concrete support pillar. Some ex-prisoners have claimed the Cyclone B was tipped down the hollow support columns. Looking along the collapsed roof under Crema 2, and we see no blue staining that should have been there had Cyclone B been used here. The only chamber still undestroyed is in the Auschwitz main camp, but it too is a comedy of errors. Whereas the prisoners had a swimming pool next to their barracks, the Germans supposedly built this gas chamber only 20 paces from their SS restaurant and hospital. According to the Polish tour guides, the only method of getting the poisonous gas out of this large chamber was to open 2 flimsy, unsealed doors and let the wind blow hundreds of cubic meters of poisonous gas out onto the street. The only evidence we could find on the inside of the chamber was evidence of incompetence. The roof holes have, once again, been crudely smashed through the concrete. Fixtures that probably belonged to toilets have been removed, but proving this alleged gas chamber once had a toilet. And then there is the door, of flimsy wooden construction with a window, and the locking device on the inside, a door that could easily be kicked out. The tinge of blue you may see here comes from the flashed photos and not from any staining from Cyclone B on the walls, because there isn't any. Back up on the roof, Dr. Tobin points out the crematorium chimney, a chimney that is not found on any Allied aerial photos at the time. But we believe it was added later by the Russians. But whoever added it did not bother even attaching it to the building. Across the roof, Dr. Tobin points out how ludicrous it is to imagine an SS man standing up on this roof in a strong wind, trying to hold the poison-soaked roof cover in one hand, and with the other hand, trying to pour highly poisonous crystals down into these holes without getting powder all over himself, and have it blown all over the rest of the camp as well, especially with his own barracks just over the road. And we can only wonder in amazement at what the camp commandant did on those days when the wind was blowing in his direction, because his own house is on the same street and less than 60 meters from this chamber. Although it is still presented to the public as a gas chamber, who is naive enough to believe that German engineers, who were already developing rockets capable of space travel, designed this? If Auschwitz were not presented as a house of horrors, tourists would stay away in droves. So when you take a tour of the camps, you are shown Soviet war propaganda films, and the guides try and outdo each other in horror stories. Go alone, and you will find the swimming pool, for example, which is on Birch Alley, behind blocks 6 and 7 in Auschwitz main camp. On summer weekends, the prisoners even held international swimming races here. The tour guides will not point out the camp post office, which offered twice weekly pickups and deliveries. The sign is badly weathered now. It used to say Häftlingspaketstube, or Prisoner's Packet Post. Nobody will mention the first building on the left in the camp entrance, which held the camp library on the bottom floor. Upstairs in the same building, 10 women ran a brothel for the prisoners. The camp authorities admit it was the brothel, but claimed it was used more by the SS guards. Everybody knows by now that even the influential industrialist Oskar Schindler was jailed for kissing a young Jewish woman in a friendly manner. Having sex with non-Aryans, and especially Jews, resulted in very harsh punishment. So you can be absolutely certain the SS guards would have stringently avoided this facility. This is a theater in the main camp where shows were put on and where some of the camp's many orchestras practiced, and children attended day art classes. But because that's not a gruesome enough story, the official guidebook will try and tell you that this building was used to store Cyclone B canisters and articles stolen from prisoners. However, photos exist that prove our claim. Guides will avoid pointing out to you the camp hospital, where the German sign reads, Intensive Care Station. According to the Sydney Jewish News, Jewish doctors like Hadassah Rosenzaft and dentists like Benjamin Jacobs worked here in the infirmary, saving the lives of hundreds of sick Jewish prisoners. Across in Birkenau, no tour guide will point out where the prisoners' football field was. In this scene, it is the empty field in the background of the ruins. Prisoners in the camps often organized team sports events, as shown in this football draw. And after you've been shown piles and piles of clothing and shoes in the museum, which are no proof of mass murder anyway, because everyone knows inmates were issued prison uniforms, not one guide will point out to you that many exhibits are sitting on a false floor, which gives a false impression of how many articles exist. Guides will point out the kitchens, but they will forget to mention the kitchens had a diet section. These photos show women who have obviously been badly treated and are terrified of being inducted into a Nazi concentration camp. Next, we see the courtroom in the main camp, where judges were brought in from Krakow to try cases. If the Nazis were just arbitrarily murdering people by the thousands just for being Jewish, what crime warranted a trial? Up until recently, this plaque claimed 4 million had been murdered. The death toll is now claimed to be 1.5 million. But surprisingly, the 6 million number has not been reduced accordingly. Why not? During the war, Auschwitz had its own fairly large photographic studio and darkrooms, run by 2 German guards and staffed by 10 to 12 prisoners. Many of the hundreds of thousands of photos taken now adorn the walls of the barracks. We want to show you how camp life looked on photos, as opposed to how some prisoners depicted in artwork the way they wanted it to be seen. These drawings, for example, show groups of starving, broken inmates, and the artist calls them waiting to die. Then we have the photos of healthy, well-fed prisoners, adults and children, not taken as propaganda by the Germans, but taken by the Russians after they had captured the camp. This photo shows the daily delivery of meals as a very placid event, but the artist turned it into a fight for survival. In this drawing, prisoners are being led out on a work detail in the middle of winter. No shoes, no hats, coats or gloves. However, photos also taken on winter work details show the prisoners had greatcoats, hats, earmuffs, gloves and boots, and they do not appear to be under any duress. Another favorite theme of the artists are the beatings, bashings, and murders supposedly perpetrated by vicious guards. But although hundreds of thousands of photographs were saved from destruction by the inmates at war's end, we could not find any photographs that showed prisoners were being mishandled. So we can only conclude the artists have used what is known as artistic license. In these photographs, we could only see 1 or 2 guards, if any at all. One civilian organization which played a major role in the concentration camps during the war was the International Red Cross. It is not a well-known fact, but throughout the Second World War, the International Red Cross had observers stationed in German concentration camps. And, at the insistence of Adolf Hitler and the German High Command, they often sent group delegations in to inspect the conditions in the camps. Seen here on an inspection tour of a camp hospital and kitchens, these delegations reported quite openly that they had seen well-run hospitals, the food was good, they had seen post offices, banks, and schools, but they had not seen any gas chambers in any camp during or after the war. As late as January 1989, a representative of the International Red Cross confirmed their wartime presence in the camps, as well as their findings about the camps. This confirmation was given during testimony at a civil trial in Canada. It was also put in writing. You are looking at a photocopy of this letter. Suddenly, in 1997, the Red Cross has apologized to Israel for keeping quiet during the Holocaust, and now claims the Nazis had cleaned up the camps in readiness for their visits and had built the banks, post offices, and schools to fool them. This article, taken from the Sydney Jewish newspaper, keeps quiet about what the Red Cross has been keeping quiet about. But obviously, no amount of expense was too much for the Nazis when it came to fooling the Red Cross on a very large scale, because in many camps the prisoners had large soccer fields and arranged football leaguers, and the Jews even conspired with the Nazis by printing their own money and making their own coins for the shops and the banks. But as the International Red Cross was created by the Rothschild family, it's hardly surprising they've changed their tune.
After editing this tape, two minor points need to be corrected. One, although some fumigation units in Auschwitz use Zyklon B gas, the delousing units in the so-called sauna use steam and not hot air to fumigate clothing, bedding, and so on. And two, the number of bodies cremated in Birkenau was 16 bodies per retort per crematorium. Before I answer the only question still open, let me recall some of the most important points in this film. 1. Despite politically correct opinion, Hitler did not start the war. Nor did he declare war. War was forced on him, firstly by the international Zionists, followed by Great Britain and France. 2. Hitler's final solution, or Endlösung, was a mutual contract signed with the Zionists to deport Jews to Madagascar. Another agreement, known as the Havara Agreement, was knowingly sabotaged by the international Zionists, who wanted lots of Jewish war victims so as to gain Palestine. 3. None of the concentration camps had gas chambers. Those alleged gas chambers shown to tourists in Auschwitz were mortuaries and technically useless for anything else. As well, there was never enough coke or fuel in Auschwitz to cremate more than 16 bodies per crematorium retort per day. According to Jewish authors Deborah Dwork and Robert Jan van Pelt in their book Auschwitz from 1270 to the present, published in 1996, the alleged gas chambers at Auschwitz in the main camp, known as Crema 1, presented to tourists as an authentic gas chamber for over 40 years, is nothing but a fraud. 4. Although many prisoners unfortunately died as a result of disease, the German military machine did what it could to keep prisoners healthy by providing fumigation units and hospitals, and in many cases, more food than the German population was getting, except during the last few months of the war when, owing to the extreme Allied bombing campaigns, supply had collapsed. Seen statistically, more prisoners survived the war in concentration camps than Germans survived the firebombing holocaust of German cities such as Dresden, Hamburg, and Pforzheim. So the only question still left open is this: what happened to the alleged 6 million dead? Many hundred thousands of Jews emigrated from Europe before the war. Approximately a quarter of a million died as a result of old age, malnourishment, and disease in the camps and ghettos. A Jewish military brigade group was formed during the war, and at least a million Jews fought in uniform, and many fell in action. Other Jews, pretending to be civilians but murdering from ambushes, died as partisans. Thousands of Jewish communities in Poland, Russia, Hungary, Romania, and Czechoslovakia were destroyed by their own anti-Jewish groups, and not by Germans. On the 17th of November 1941, Stalin actually sent out order number 0428, ordering special murder squads to dress in German uniforms and slaughter civilians behind German lines, always leaving a few survivors that could blame the murders on the Germans. Many Jews continued to live unmolested in Germany and occupied territory, and many of them were killed as a result of the Allied bombing raids. One day before Germany surrendered, British bombers attacked and sank in Lübeck Bay the Kap Arkona and the Tielbeck, killing 8,000 Jewish patients from Neuengamme and Bergen-Belsen camps, as well as many German medical staff. After the war, many thousands of Jews liberated from concentration camps in the East were immediately enslaved as laborers by the Russians. Interestingly, as Jewish populations in Europe dropped dramatically, they rose just as dramatically in other countries, such as Israel, the United States, South Africa, and South America, as well as Australia. Many more Jews decided they had had enough of being Jewish, and they changed their names and religion.
The British started bombing German cities months before Germany retaliated, and more bombs were dropped on Berlin in one day than the Germans dropped on Great Britain throughout the whole war. This man, Bomber Harris, was responsible for burning alive hundreds of thousands of innocent women and children, and the British built memorials to him. This man, Rudolf Hess, flew to Scotland in 1941 in a last-ditch effort to make peace with the Allies. He was pronounced to be mad, was sentenced to life imprisonment, and over 40 years later, just before his release, British agents strangled him to death in Spandau Prison. His memorial was destroyed. So, who really wanted war?
The sun on the meadow is summery.
In these mass graves in the city of Hamburg lie the bodies of more than 37,000 people, mostly grandparents, women and children, who had been burned to death in just a few nights of bombing. The firestorm set off by the bombing could be seen for many miles around, and thousands of charred bodies filled the streets. But the bombing did more than kill thousands of innocent civilians. There was no more running water, and the roads and railways had been destroyed, so that food and medical supplies could not be delivered anywhere. People all over Germany were hiding in cellars. All their possessions had been destroyed, and they were suffering from illness, cold, and a terrible lack of food. The concentration camps, where thousands of people were squeezed in together, were also in trouble. Some camps had been bombed, and many thousands of prisoners had been killed by Allied bombers. And because they were outside the larger cities, the camps could not be supplied with water, food, or medical supplies. Many thousands of prisoners were dying from illness and malnourishment. The commandant of Bergen-Belsen even sent a radio message to Berlin begging for help. However, when the war ended in 1945, instead of telling the world the truth that these prisoners had died as a result of hardship and illness caused by the bombings, the Allies covered up for their atrocities by claiming that the Nazis had been murdering millions of their prisoners in large gas chambers in the concentration camps. They even managed to find some people who claimed to have witnessed these gassings. The eyewitness stories are so bizarre that many chemists, engineers and historians are convinced that these stories are untrue and that it is chemically and technically impossible to gas people to death the way the so-called eyewitnesses say it occurred. We decided that the only way we would really know if it was possible or not would be to recreate a gassing using Cyclone B, the chemical the Nazis are accused of using, and of course, with real people. But before we go to our experiment, we'd like to show you some facts about Cyclone B. This is the Jewish professor, Fritz Haber, who developed the insecticide Cyclone B, and it was used extensively throughout the United States and Europe. In Hamburg, the firm of Teschenstabenow have been making Cyclone B plus other insecticides since 1924. Cyclone B was used mainly for disinfecting ships, factories, homes, and hospitals. In the beginning, it was made by simply pouring the liquid hydrocyanic acid over pellets of plaster of Paris that absorbed the poison, as you will see in the following promotional film made by the firm of Teschenstabenow in the early 30s. The pellets were then poured out and left to work for up to 24 hours before the building was aired.
Die IG gibt sich weltoffen und exportorientiert. Ihre Produkte sind rund um den Globus. Geworben wird auch für ein Produkt aus Dessau. Zyklon B. Das Gift wurde zur Schädlingsbekämpfung in Schiffen, Kasernen und Mühlen entwickelt.
Schädlinge sehen dich an. Schädlinge bedrohen das Werk deiner Hände. Blausäure, die Anwendungsart. Man lässt sie von porösen Gipswürfeln aufsaugen, die dann in gewöhnlichen Blechbüchsen gasdicht verschlossen werden. Mit Blausäure durchgast man größte Betriebe ohne jede Gefahr für Mensch und Material. Die Fenster werden gasdicht verklebt. Die feindlichen Stellungen freigelegt. Hier sitzt der Feind. Die Mehlmotte und ihre Larve. Gas! Gas! Jetzt geht es allem Ungeziefer zu Leibe. Selbst die Ratten können dieses Gas nicht vertragen. Kakerlaken und Schwaben haben die Waffen schon vorher gesteckt.
Cyclone B only has a shelf life of a few months, but we managed to obtain sufficient amounts of the modern product, now called cyanosil, and we made it up exactly as it had been made in the past. We put it in the same type of container and sealed it off with a leak-proof ceramic sealant. Our experiment was now ready to go ahead. But first, we want to show you and want you to listen very carefully to what so-called eyewitnesses said about how the Nazis allegedly carried out their gassings. It was a normal, cool summer's day in Germany when we set off in two cars to carry out our experiment. We had four young German men as volunteers and a woman doctor who had volunteered to come along and help us. To avoid prosecution and harassment, we have hidden the identity of all the people on this film. Who they are is really unimportant. What is important is the fact they were willing to risk their lives to find out the truth of whether their fathers and grandfathers were murderers or whether we have all been victims of a huge propaganda lie. On arriving at the grounds of the former concentration camp, where we planned to do our experiment, we unpacked. We had brought with us 2 1-kilo cans of cyanosil, or Cyclone B, a gas mask, and 2 bottles of oxygen in case of an accident, an electronic clock thermometer. According to our temperature gauge, the outside temperature here is just on 15.7 degrees Celsius in the early afternoon. The ambient temperature is one of the main danger factors with Cyclone B. On our many visits to Auschwitz, we have checked the ambient temperature in the alleged gas chambers, and the temperature varies from below 5 degrees up to around 17 degrees Celsius just in summer. The bunker we have chosen is airtight, quite small, and has heavy steel locks. The men are nervous as our doctor checks their vital signs prior to them going inside. Our doctor, wearing a gas mask, cuts open the can of cyanosil and then pours it onto a small ledge. This can contains the equivalent of 1 kilo of Cyclone B. For 3 men, this is 72 times the amount of poison the Nazis supposedly used in Auschwitz. They will be staying inside the bunker for an hour. This is 5 times longer than it allegedly took to kill thousands of people in Auschwitz. The clock shows it is 33 minutes past 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Time for the men to go into the bunker. The door is unlocked and the men go in. We have agreed that knocking signals every 5 minutes will let us know that they are okay. Our doctor is starting to get nervous. It is now 2:33 in the afternoon, time for the boys to come out again. And our doctor carries out a last check, their breathing functions, pulse rate, and blood pressure.
So you've seen the film footage. Can you tell us why these men could stay in a room full of poisonous gas for an hour without getting very ill or even dying?
Zircon B is a liquid. And before the liquid can take effect, it must vaporize. And the higher the temperature of the room, the faster it will vaporize at a room temperature of 15 to 16 degrees. As is seen on the film, it would take around 16 to 18 hours before there is enough gas to be fed to humans.
Good then. How warm does it have to be before Cyclone B is vaporizing fast enough to be dangerous to humans?
It needs to have an ambient room temperature of 26 degrees or above for the Cyclone B to give off enough gas, and even then it would take around 6 hours to kill these people.
Occasionally we see gangster movies or documentaries, criminals in America being executed with Cyclone B. And this only takes a few minutes. What's the difference?
In America, the Zircon pellets fall into a strong acid to assist the process, and therefore the gas is given off immediately.
So how quickly would the Cyclone pellets give up their gas by, say, 30 degrees?
At 30 degrees, it would take around 3 hours for enough gas to be given off.
But we have testimony from alleged eyewitnesses who swear that the people sent into the gas chambers in the Nazi concentration camps all died within 3 to 15 minutes, even in winter?
That's stupid and technically impossible. It's common practice for courts to take forensic evidence over eyewitness evidence every time, as eyewitness evidence is always affected by receding time and contradictions.